Okay, good morning. First, thank you very much to the organizers for the invitation. And thanks to the previous presenters because they will help me to go faster to some of the slides. Let's see what can we know, just a little of history. Before radio astronomy, only two supernova remnants were known, Crabbe and Kepler supernova remnant. And in the very early times of radio astronomy, Ryland Smith detected a very bright radio source that happened to see Cassiopeia A, but its nature was completely unknown. So the first detections with a radio telescope just pointing to supernova remnants were towards Crabbe, Tycho, and Kepler's supernova. And from those early studies, two conclusions were drawn, that the supernova remnant is a source of intense radio radiation, and the origin, that was really surprising for the radio astronomers, that the origin could not be explained by strictly thermal processes. And the answer came in 1953, proposed by Shklovsky, based on solutions that Alfven and Herlofson had proposed for a different context. And then he said it was synchrotron radiation from relativistic electrons or Bagni. And Shklovsky imagined the compact remnant with a trapped magnetic field around. And these and cosmic rays, supplemented by Fermi processes, could have been responsible. I mean, the path that Shklovsky followed was exactly the opposite of the former ones. Instead of extrapolating mechanisms that worked in optical to radio, he extrapolated from radio to optical and said, if we detect polarization in Crabbe, this is the mechanism. So in our galaxy now, you will see that the statistics will completely differ from what Samar Safiar presented or Laura Lopez in high energies. In radio, the statistics are different. But among the almost 300, the 294 remnants identified in our galaxy, 8% are detected in TeV range, 10% in GeV, 30% in optical wavelengths, 40% in X-rays, and 95% in radio. So radio telescope, only 12 supernova remnants have not been identified or clearly detected with radio telescopes. So this is our tool to search for. And in the Magellanic Clouds, it's also the 5% of sources that have not been detected in radio. So why are important radio observations? We can learn morphology, brightness distribution, spectral index, and polarization. This is all the information that we can get from radio telescopes. And it's important to delimit the location of the expanding shock front, identify sites and mechanisms of particle acceleration, and infer orientation and degree of order of magnetic field. So let's see what can we learn from morphology and brightness distribution. So we in a galaxy like the Milky Way, we expect about 20% of explosion of this type, thermonuclear collapse, and about 80% of core collapse, gravitational collapse. So just after the beautiful cartoon that presented, this is very rough, but nevertheless. Let's start far from the explosion. Now we already have the shock sweeping up interstellar medium. So for all the SN1A explosions, we expect to see this a shell of synchrotron emission. And for the rest, we expect for the 80% of core collapse is the shell of synchrotron emission plus synchrotron emission in the interior with a pulsar. This is all what is predicted by the theory. Plus contact discontinuity and instabilities. So for the 20%, we expect the shell, and we observe shell types. And for the rest, we expect to see composite in radio and field center or pleurions. However, over 70% of the Milky Way supernova remnants have a shell type morphology in radio. 12% have this composite with a pulsar wing nebula in the interior and a shell, and 5% are pure pleurions. The rest do not fit into any class, although among these 70%, less than 20% show an almost complete ring appearance. In fact, beside this class, these are just composite mixed morphology. We still retain the shell type morphology in radio, but the emission in X-rays is field center. Here, radio is in pink, and X-rays in blue, and the famous W28. In fact, the shape, here is quite different from Laura Lopez presented, because in radio, the shape is mostly determined by the environment and the age. So while it is still young, it retains the circular symmetry. But if it finds a large difference in density in the interstellar medium, it expands in a cavity. Or here, for example, with the jets provided by SS-433 that disturbed the evolution of the shell-type remnant produced these ears. And in this case, whether the pulsar rejuvenated the energy injected by the pulsar rejuvenated a remnant, and a remnant that is expanding into a very irregular interstellar medium, or you have these kinds, really funny shapes, where probably magnetic fields have something to do with the morphology. So when the radio remnant is well behaved and follows the theoretical predictions, you can see, like in Cassay, this is the reverse shock, very well traced by a bright ring, and a fainter radio plateau showing the expanding shock front. In X-rays, the forward shock is better traced. But for example, tracing radial profiles, in X-rays, it is very well marked, the outer shock front, and here in radio intensity. This is not always the case that they coincide. For example, in Puppies A, here is a radio image at 330 megahertz. And this is a composite X-ray image produced with after the combination of 51 different observations of Chandra and XMM. By the way, this is to Noam. Here we have 2 ears exactly opposite in the direction of the neutron star. What happened when we compare radio with X-rays? Here, the white contours are showing the radio remnant. And here is the X-rays, and here it's compared with infrared, Spitzer image. And it's not because of the difference in time, the 4 or 5 years that laps between the X-rays and the radio image. It's much larger, and besides, some of the features are perfectly matched in X-rays and radio, or in radio and infrared. So this plateau here, we think that this faint radio plateau, like in the other case, may represent the precursor synchrotron radiation from relativistic electrons that diffused upstream the shock. And all along the eastern flank of Papisei, exactly touching the border, the radio border, there is an H1 cloud. We also studied, searched for the molecular gas, and there is. In fact, there is a large molecular cloud here, but it's slightly detached from the radio limb of the supernova remnant. So probably this precursor has dissociated the molecules. So we can see the neutral gas, the H1 gas, but not the molecular here, for example, is being heated and is radiating in X-rays. In this case, for example, in addition, radio and X-rays, in addition to the clean border, there is this kind of protrusions that in X-rays are more evident, these departures from the bright rim, that when we studied the neutral hydrogen, we found that at the same kinematical velocities where there is a cloud that is probably responsible for the bright H-alpha filaments shown by Winkler yesterday, there is another one in touch with the remnant, and there will be a talk about this behavior later. But something, the surrounding medium has really an important role in the appearance, and not only at large scale. Well, if we look for radio remnants, there are missing remnants, because the total discovered in our galaxy is only one third of the expected number of supernova remnants in the Milky Way. Maybe we are missing two young remnants, or very old and faint because of lack of sensitivity. In this case, the observations at low radio frequencies, but with high angular resolution, like those mentioned by Maria Arias with LOFAR, it's very important to search for these missing sources. And one question is, can the supernova explosion type be constrained from radio observations, as in the case for X-rays like Laura mentioned? Well, the answer is no. No. Once the shock front sweeps up certain amount of ambient gas, radio synchrotron ignores, forgets the origin. And it's only conditioned by the surrounding medium. And we don't have chemical traces. So it loses the physical traces, and radio synchrotron has no chemical indication. So except if you find a compact source, neutron star, or a pulsar wind nebula, or if it is evolving very close to a molecular cloud that you imagine that was the born place of the pre-supernova star, you cannot guess what was the what kind of explosion produced the radio remnant that you are observing. The other information that we can get is spectrum. This is taken, updated from Reynolds' histogram. In this case, I plotted the spectral indices of shell type remnants. Theory predicts that the shell, the radio synchrotron shell, should have a spectrum with a spectral index minus 0.5. Here in solid color, they are included all the shell type remnants with well established spectral index. And here, those that have a question mark in Dave Green's catalog, so there's not well established. So we can see that, in fact, there is a maximum around 0.5, but we have a good number of remnants with spectral index varying between 0.3 and 0.8 approximately. So what can be the origin of the flat spectrum indices lower than 0.5? It is indicating efficient particle acceleration or contamination with pulsar wave nebula inside the remnant, or contamination with thermal gas outside along the line of sight. While steep spectrum, steep spectrum indicates shocks with very low Mach numbers, but this must be very old remnants, or poor magnetic compression, or inefficient particle acceleration. However, young remnants are expected to be very efficient accelerators, and to have this behavior, this spectral behavior. However, for example, for CASE is 0.7, for Tycho and SN1006, 0.6, for 1987, 8.8, and radio supernovae have indices as deep as 0.9 or 1. So one explanation for this was proposed by Bell, 2011, in this paper. This can be explained by the orientation of the magnetic field. Quasi-perpendicular orientation produces steeper indices. The other thing that we can explore is the curvature of the spectrum in a log-log plot. For example, this is the case of Tycho's remnant, this line. Concave up radio spectrum is showing us nonlinear diffusive shock acceleration. And concave down spectrum, probably DSA with plus the effect of synchrotron losses within a finite emission region. So reading the curvature of the spectrum, we can have an idea of the acceleration mechanism. But I want to show you some of what is really dealing with observations. Usually, if you see this curvature at low radio frequency, this turnover, are usually extrinsic due to absorption by intervening thermal material along the line of sight, but also can be synchrotron self-absorption, intrinsic free-free absorption. We have to be very careful, and the fitting of the line depends strongly on data at low frequencies. And up to very recently, radio telescopes at low frequencies were not very efficient. I mean, the angular resolution at low frequencies is quite bad. And you have to deal with ionospheric problems, some problems. So there are very few observations, much less data that at other frequencies, and they are not good enough. It's only now with LOFAR, MWA, and SKA, we will have good data at low frequencies. And this is what anchors the spectrum. In fact, the low frequencies is what anchors the spectrum. And even when you put all the efforts in getting the best spectrum possible, taking all the information to the same scale, etc., even then, you see, I wanted to show you two cases where we work it a lot, and there is a large spread, and you can fit one line or other it's not an easy task. So the numbers that are published about spectral indices, you have to take into account all this spread. And also, you mentioned, we usually mention the average spectrum. But for example, in W44, we have a large variation. And here, for example, is almost positive. And here, we have 0.7, 2.7 to zero. In this case, we were surprised about this very flat spectrum, but it was when we combined with infrared image, it was just an overlapping H2 region with star formation there. And in this case, for example, the study of the spectral variation in IC443, here yellow means flat indices, but yellow here is because of the it here coincides with the ionic lines observed in near infrared. So this is ionized gas in front of the shock front. And here it coincides with the Veritas detection and a molecular gas. So probably the meaning of yellow here is that there is efficient particle acceleration. So there are several problems. And only one form just studied the theory, and the rest is not following what is predicted. And 44%, almost half of the remnants classified of shell type have poorly determined. So spectral studies are strongly needed. And single dish, it's a low angular resolution, and you can have confusion with other sources. But interferometers is not always better because you can miss, it's a spatial filter and you can miss flats. And sometimes you have to face determining spectral indices in sources like this. So just a little portion is observed and the rest is extrapolated. Well, polarization, thanks to Wolfgang Reich, I can go faster. So from theory, it's expected 70% of fractional polarization for synchrotron sources. But in general, it's never observed higher than 10 on 15. And when we observe higher polarization percentage, is because it's in sources far from the galactic plane. It is usually at high latitudes. So sources are depolarized because of intrinsic disorder, instrumental effects, or Faraday rotation in the foreground medium and inside the remnant. So, and what the radio telescope give us is electric field directions. Just to convert into B field, we need a very good estimate of rotation measure. And this is quite difficult. Most of the times it's very difficult. There is now this rotation measure synthesis techniques that was developed for extragalactic sources. And I saw one case where it was applied to a supernova remnant. It seems to be a very good technique that can be done with the radio telescope with broadband receivers. And here, for example, I took the example of a young remnant when it's usually said the B field is radial and in all remnant is tangential. Well, in this case, we have radial and tangential in this, depending on the area of the source. And the largest polarization percentage is attained at the minimum synchrotron emission. This is curious. One thing that I forgot to mention about spectral variety across a remnant, that in general, spectral variation have no correlation with brightness features, are uncorrelated with brightness features. So some new, in the last minutes, I will show some new results obtained from the Crab Nebula. This was a project started, it's with Kargaltsev, Pavlov, Michael Wittenholz, it's to study spectral variation around the pulsar for the main features near the pulsar, and in combination with Chandra and HST observations that were taken almost in the same temporal, in a small temporal window, just before the features expand too much. So we took a new JVLA image at 3 gigahertz with sub-arcsecond angular resolution, very good noise level, and we can see very detailed features. And this is part of the ALMA. We use for the first time ALMA to observe in continuum at 100 gigahertz the central part. Unfortunately, because we wanted to save time, we observe only the central part. This is a large mosaic. And it was not very, we couldn't get a well-calibrated image because the rest of the SIR is too bright. So we need to apply for more time. In any case, just in comparison with X-ray, with this deep image, well, here we see this secondary shed and this feature, for example, and this, and we found exactly the correspondent for the first time we could show. Here is the location of the pulsar, the correspondent features in radio, and also here this extension is here. When we compare the optical with optical emission, with HST we have the continuum synchrotron radiation and all the ionized lines as 2001 and 03. I just took a couple of examples here. Here radio is in blue and optical continuum red, and we can see a perfect matching of this undulated border in radio are optical synchrotron. And here I use green for radio and red for optical. And we can see that the thermal filaments, the more ionized, form like a cage of thermal filaments, leaving all the remnant inside the synchrotron radiation. And there are very good coincidences only in some of the filaments and wisps. Also, in comparison with infrared emission, thanks to Temin for providing the Spitzer images. So we have that, here we compare, look, these are the bays, bays are called, these two cavities that have the remnant, and is surrounded by a maximum in radio. Here, when we compare with infrared, we can see how the radio exactly delimits the infrared emission. So, summary, almost 70 years after first detection of a supernova remnant with radio telescopes, great progress has been achieved, and there are lots of things to learn yet from radio astronomy. And I would like to take the chance to invite you from one beautiful island to another beautiful island. This is an IAU symposium that was just a couple of weeks ago approved by the International Astronomical Union in celebration of the 30 years of SN87A. I invite you to see the poster at the entrance of the conference room. So this is a completely scientific appealing, just to come to this symposium. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Gloria. Questions?
Yeah.
Vikram?
Hi, Nice. So a couple of questions and comments. You showed some nice listings of all the supernova remnants, and you said many of them are not observed, 300 out of 900.
Are not observed?
Are not seen at all. We would expect to see a lot more in the galaxy than are seen. I guess part of the reason, of course, is that many supernovae evolve in low-density wind bubbles, for example, and you'd expect them to be in a very low. So I guess X-ray and optical emission would be pretty low, but I think low-frequency radio would probably be the best chance out there, right? So,
hopefully
we should see a lot more of these in the next few years. I think that's a big case for some of these. I had a comment. You mentioned about the steep spectrum in some of these, but wouldn't synchrotron losses also be a big reason for that?
I think that the people who make research in theory of spectrum can answer better than I. I think that we try to take the best data to fit. I don't have an explanation except for that of the orientation of the B field.
I'm sure it should contribute a little bit. Also, I know that many of these... Pardon? Well, many of them are actually pretty high, in fact. But we look at a lot of younger supernovae where the magnetic fields are far higher. And we can talk. Yeah. Okay, we can talk about that. And one more thing. I was going to say. You mentioned about the evolution of the spectral index in time. Is there good evidence for a change in spectral index around the remnants?
No, I didn't mention about evolution in time of spectral index.
Okay, you did, but we know what happens. We know what happens, especially in 87A, for example. It started off as one or something. I mean,
minus 0.7 at the moment, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we know what happens. Is there evolution around the remnant? Is there any evidence for that good change in spectral index?
Well, I think that now we can have a good database to...
Dave?
To investigate better.
Dave has an answer.
A comment on that, and it relates to some things that Gloria did mention. A big problem with doing very accurate radio spectral indices of many remnants is that you have to put them on the same flux density scales. You have to put all the measurements on the same flux density scale. There are systematic problems between many of the historical scales that are used. The most common one that has been used for a long time is Bars et al. But the higher frequencies that are calibrated by the CMB, there are some systematic offsets at the levels of 5, even 10%. And a lot of this is due to the fact that the Bars et al. Flux density scale is tied to the spectrum of Cas A, because Cas A is the brightest thing that you can do absolute measurements against. But Cas A is fading with time, and it's flattening with time. And so if you're comparing observations made now with observations made 10 or 20 years ago, tied to a different flux scale, it's really, you have to be very, very careful to get all the fluxes on a comparable flux density scale. But Cas A is the best studied object because it's the brightest. It's flattening with time. It's fading with time, and it's flattening.
Yes.
We have one more question here.
So you said we are seeing about one-third of the expected supernova remnants. And I guess that fraction depends on the lifetime of radio supernova remnants.
Depends on what?
Lifetime. So I'm curious what you think the lifetime of radio supernova remnant is. Because if supernova rate is about every 40 years, and the lifetime is, say, 100,000 years, we expect more than 2,000 or 3,000 supernova remnants, so the fraction will be much less than one-third. So I'm curious what lifetime you think the radio supernova remnant.
Most of the remnants we are detecting are younger than 10,000 years. So it's between a few hundred years before and 10,000 or 20,000 years. It's really very rare to find older rainier remnants. Maybe they dissipated, but they're still lacking the younger. As we didn't observe anyone in our galaxy after Cassiopeia, or so even in radio, they're still missing.
So let me solve that, at least 10% of that problem right now. Melanie, maybe you can tell us about 20 new MWA. Yes.
Yes, hello. I don't actually work on supernova remnants. I'm a gatecrasher here. But the reason that I'm here is because I'm just about to publish a catalogue of supernova remnants detected with the Murchison Wide Field Array at low frequencies using the GLEAM survey. So in the strip between galactic latitudes or longitudes of 260 to 340, there are 29 new supernova remnants unambiguously detected with the MWA, nine of which are listed as candidates in Dave Green's catalogue, and the rest of them are completely unknown, including ones which are seen in projection through H2 regions. So that's going to come out soon.
Okay. Right. Thanks.
More questions? Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for your lovely talk. I have two quick questions. One is, you were talking about the radio emission extending ahead of, I think it was Puppis A, you were saying that might be coming from the cosmic ray precursor. Do you know what the length scale of that is in physical units?
Yes, I measured and compared with predicted, and it's okay. It's what is expected. Okay. Also, in W44, on the eastern side, there is a weak plateau, and also has in that case there is not X-ray emission from the border because it's all in the interior. But this weak plateau has the right length.
Okay, so it's efficient. It's consistent with very efficient acceleration, or not very much.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the other one was, if you could go to the picture of SN1006, you had the X-ray and the radio. Okay, I got to go all the way back.
Yes, because it was one here.
Right. So my question is, I've always noticed this about the X-ray, and I think I see a little bit of it in the radio. What are these minima here, especially this stripe that looks dark? I don't know if anyone's ever determined what causes that, but it just seems like there's just a total lack of emission there from the ejecta from here.
Oh, yes. And it's the same in radio. Right. Yes. Exactly coincident in radio.
So one thing to remark on that, actually, there must be a shock there, because you see it's alpha emission also having something there. This was what Winkler's map showed. So there must be some sort of a bulging out, I guess, in order to get really its alpha emission there. It's curving. You need something more, but certainly the symmetry that you see on the sky is not the symmetry if you would look from another side.
Interesting.
Okay, thank you. One more question we have here.
Just to add to the question of very old supernova remnants, in the conference poster, there is one example which is estimated to be 100,000 or even elder, this S147. It is well be studied in the radio. And the interesting case in that is that you have two distinct areas, two distinct structures, that is filaments which have a typical spectrum of about 0.4, 0.5, and the diffuse emission, which has a steepening and obviously reflects, because the magnetic is so low, the cosmic ray spectrum of the galaxy. So there is also a reason that for many supernova remnants you observe a steep spectrum where you have a magnetic field, but the cosmic rays are from the background, not accelerated, and this is steep, it's about 0.7 to 0.8.
Okay,
that's good. Okay, and last question here.
So, the point of how how long a radio supernova remnant will last. You were mentioned before about the, until the dissipation time. With the work I did with Oliver Druck, we found as a byproduct a result that, for some reasons, statistically speaking, it looks like the efficiency in radio decreases considerably at the end, near the end of the setup phase. My question is, but do you have some or many radio supernova remnants for which you can prove that they are much beyond the setup phase? There should be many, because along the lifetime of the supernova remnant, most of the time should be in the radiative phase.
I don't have the answer, but what I can tell you is that only a small fraction of supernova remnants have ages well established. So, in fact, when I said younger than 20,000, 30,000, those are the sources that have ages. So I think that we are still far from the point of answering your question. We need to better establish the age based on other indicators. Sorry.
Thanks very much once again, Gloria.